This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
When the nights get cold and the lights go out, the sun is gone behind the clouds, and you feel lost, and I'll reach out to guide you home with my lighthouse. Oh, whoa, oh, whoa.
Welcome to Lighthouse of Hope. I'm your host, Michael Hempseed. I'm so glad you're joining us today. On today's show, we have Josiah from the Mental Health Inquiry. Welcome to the show.
Kia ora, Michael. Kia ora, whānau.
Great. And Josiah, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm 23 years of age, born in Dunedin, but have grown up in Christchurch. My family live out by the beach in Parklands, so I've always really loved Bottle Lake Forest and, you know, getting out there amongst nature. I'm a big Lego collector.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, favourite Lego set or what?
Millennium Falcon, definitely.
Oh, excellent.
And I really care about people's well-being. I sort of got involved in this space just by my own lived experience, and my mum's a nurse and my family are very involved in health, and it just seemed like something that was quite cool. So I started talking about my own journey, and then got involved in setting up a wee charity called Pilot, Pacific Youth Leadership and Transformation, which sort of was a place where we could talk about belongingness for Pacific young people, and that was an important part of me finding that my own identity as a New Zealand born Samoan, as someone who can't speak Samoan, is great, and that's quite normal. And then from there, I end up on the board of Lewa, so I'm on the board of Lewa now, and then this last year gone, I was asked by the government to represent young people and be a voice for them on the Mental Health and Addictions Inquiry panel from January till November.
Hmm. Fantastic. So you've done a lot in your 23 years.
A little bit, but it's all been in community, though. I guess that's one of the things that really matters to me, is never really having to do something by myself, and that's how I've got through. Mm.
We'll definitely talk about community in a little bit. So tell us about the Mental Health Inquiry. What did that involve and the submissions and the process? Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So before the 2017 election, the new government, at the time had heard really strongly from across New Zealand that there needed to be a fresh look at what was working and what's not working in mental health. Mike King and Kyle MacDonald and Action Station had taken a very significant national discussion to find out what people were thinking, and they presented that to the opposition spokesperson for health, Dr. David Clark, at the time. And then pretty much as the government was forming, they agreed that between New Zealand First and Labour that they would do an inquiry into mental health to honour what the people had said. And then so this year just gone in 2018, the government chose 6 panel members, and I was one of them. And together the 6 of us were tasked to hear the voices of the people across New Zealand, to report back on where we're at with mental health and addiction, and then to give recommendations for the future. So kind of to give direction for government and communities. Not too long a time frame. We had till October, and then we got a 1 month extension to the end of November. But pretty much what it looked like is we had 26 big regional meetings. Some of them had 100 people, some of them had more than 100 people. And then we had about 450 small meetings. So that was with people like psychologists, that was with people with lived experience, tangata whai ora, that was with families who have been bereaved by people with mental health challenges, it was with prisoners, it was with young people, it was with the elderly, it was with farmers out in Te Awamutu, or people up in Kaikohe who wanted to talk about addictions challenges. It was a huge task, and we met with thousands of New Zealanders. We had 5,500 submissions, and we had some very significant petitions presented to us, signed by tens of thousands of New Zealanders. So it was an absolutely amazing moment to hear what people are thinking. And then also it was a very hard time because of the pain that exists. But throughout all of that, you know, the courage we saw from people who came to share was something I will never forget. And so I guess just in this moment, if I can say thank you to them, I'd like to. That thank you to everyone, for those who are listening, who did share with us, who did come back. I know many times we've felt maybe let down by decisions that haven't been able to include us or support the change we want to see. But you came back, shared your stories, and helped give this piece of work the mana and then the understanding it needs. So now that the government has it, they can think about what matters to you.
Fantastic. So it's obviously a huge piece of work talking to so many people. What were some of the overall things that maybe stood out from you all over the country? We'll talk about some of the specific groups and areas in a minute, but sort of as a general feel all over the country, what came out of the meetings and conversations with people?
For those who might have seen the report, you may have heard this, but I guess the biggest thing for me was access. Across New Zealand, you know, whether we're in rural New Zealand and hearing that there is no access to some support, through to you know, urban New Zealand, where you might have access, but there might just be too much demand and you might not be able to get it. People saying that they're not unwell enough to get the support. People feeling like some of the support they'd like to have is not even there, like cultural support or people who have lived experience to journey alongside them. People who don't judge them and have addictions experience. That was probably one of the harder things. People coming to us at times saying, I just need somewhere, point me somewhere, help me help myself, some asked as well. Why do I have to go outside my own community? Why can't I access what I need here? And I guess underlying all of that, people were also very sending a lot of aroha to those who are doing the supporting, those who are those making access open, but feeling like they aren't able to access much support themselves. So I guess it was a very very heart-wrenching feeling having to at times sit there at the table or sit there in these public meetings, hear people talk and know, at least in this moment in time, they might not get the support they need. But people did say that they and being able to share together that helped a little bit, but obviously not necessarily changing their immediate circumstances.
Mm. So there's obviously quite a long way to go with some of this stuff. Let's talk more specifically now about some of the groups that you worked with. So let's start with, say, prisoners. So you went into a number of prisons?
Yes, we went to Rimutaka Prison in the Greater Wellington area, went to Arohata, which is the women's prison in the Greater Wellington area, went to Auckland Prison, Porimorimo, before the new building was opened. We went to the youth unit in Christchurch Men's, and then we had a couple of other prison visits, Woody Prison. Then also we had letters from prisoners and prisoners' families. Mm.
And so obviously one of the things I really like about the inquiry is that it didn't just focus on one sort of group of people, that you tried to get pretty much everyone in New Zealand that had been affected by mental illness in some way.
We did, like, for example, I mean, prisoners might be one of the a good example of a group who, you know, don't normally participate very well in things like this because, you know, they're incarcerated. It's harder to get communication. But, you know, the corrections staff really made it easy because they could kind of see, you know, at times we, as a country, we might not be dealing with the why. We come to just, you know, have a system where we ask, well, we try people for the things that they've done. But I guess it was also quite interesting going to the alcohol and drug courts where they are dealing with the why. They kind of help people confront the addictions problem which might have impacted on their offending. And then people at times had also in this kind of space asking for their family to be involved in their rehabilitation because, you know, we know that positive connection can be a real game changer, and at times it's not always there in prison.
Mm. I think there's probably a small percentage of the population that probably just need to be locked up for the rest of their lives, you know, very, very dangerous to society. But there's probably a lot of people imprisoned that are there because of poor circumstances or things like that.
Well, it's definitely something that young people and other prisoners said to us. I am a product of my circumstances. I'm trying to remember the quote, but it was something like, not being able to fend for myself, or not being able to afford to live, led to my offending. It was one of the young people we spoke to in prison. And yeah, I could definitely see that and hear that in the stories that were shared. And then there were some people who said that while I may need to be kept away from society, or while there might be others who need to be kept away from society, maybe prison isn't the best place if it is long-term enduring illness. Some people said maybe there needs to be a kind of space away from society that's similar to what the word asylum means literally, not what happened, just a place of space, of safe space, of solitude.
Like in Norway, I think they have an island where a lot of prisoners go, and there's no walls or anything like that. It's very open. That works for a lot of prisoners over there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know, but I guess just that was something that some people reflected, that they feel we can, and even in hospitals, other places, we can design environments which make it easier for people to stay well if they're chronically unwell, or if they've got some long-term illness.
Yeah. And did some of these prisoners say that, you know, 20 years ago if this happened or there was this service, maybe there'd have been a different outcome?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Some people talked about the way the system had made them distance themselves from things that might have helped.
Can you tell us a little bit about more, like how did that turn people away from some of the help that they might have needed?
Well, one of the themes I remember from our meetings was the stigma that comes from asking for help, and potentially this is a couple we reflected, it could be more difficult to ask for help in an environment which is a masculine environment, and where you're unable to decide your own time. You have a set program of things, and you to ask for help, you have to get a referral. Sorry, I guess it's quite a to get help in prison. It's quite a can be a difficult process, not always, but depending on your how safe or unsafe you are to work with, is deemed by the leaders of those spaces.
And there was a separate inquiry into state abuse, but you also worked with people that have been through what was formerly known as SIFs, now Rangatamariki. Yes. Can you tell us some of the thoughts on this, please?
Yeah, sure. So we met with young people who are in state care currently, or who have been in state care previously, and then we had people who were older who had also came and shared with us, who might have been in state care 20 years ago or a while ago. So it was interesting hearing about... for some of those who had been away for a while, saying that maybe these days they feel looking at it, things are better. For the young people today, they asked, the representatives asked that there'd be more deeper training for foster parents and other caregivers on mental health. They felt like there was some there, but it could be expanded, because I guess the undealt with trauma at times of, you know, being separated from people they love, and then having someone who understands that isn't always a guarantee, but they'd like someone to be able to at least understand the effect on their mental health and be ready to talk about it if they wanted to.
One of the really interesting findings from World War II was in London, during the Blitz, there was a whole group of children that were fostered out at the country, and then there were others that stayed with their parents and stayed in the tube stations and saw dead people in front of them. They actually found that the people that had stayed with their parents, even though they saw horrific things in central London, often did much better than those that were separated from their families.
Interesting.
So it shows that connection there is really important.
And people did reflect that. There was like a general theme across the inquiry, where it's appropriate, people had said we'd like greater involvement for families and things, whether it's involvement in those who have, you know, long long-standing enduring illness, or whether that's adult family members who are caring for their adult children, or whether that's just generally in the care of a child or young person or anyone really. Family wanting to be involved at all points and at times have been actively excluded or feeling like it's been actively excluded. That connection theme you pull up was a very strong theme around New Zealand. Mm.
Yeah, in one part of the report, it said that often the only method of treatment was the medicalisation model, in other words, prescribing medicines for this. But quite a few people talked about the importance of connections and family and some of these other things as well.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. People had said, the perception, and it seems from what people were told us that it was easier to get medical support rather than other supports. Like one of the awesome services I remember seeing in Gisborne and other places too, even here in Christchurch, was some people just wanted to do art. Like that was, they weren't asking for some huge medical intervention. They just needed something to take their mind off things and to increase their sense of self-worth, and that was bonding with others over something they appreciate, like art or music, that was enough. I think the thing for the inquiry really highlights to me is how we've got the opportunity to find different things for different people, and that's because we know no one's the same, and everybody in the country, if they need support, isn't going to necessarily want it the same way.
And no scientific study has ever found one form of treatment cures 100% of the people they study, whether it's medication, counselling, art therapy, all these other things. No one study has ever found 100% success rate. So I think that shows that there's a need for multiple interventions.
Definitely. People had talked about the excitement in some of these spaces where there was lots of options, that there was lots of options, and they felt less led to something and having more autonomy, which people talked about valuing.
In the book, The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk talks about if people had experienced childhood trauma and they developed PTSD, they often needed a very different treatment from adults that had developed PTSD during a war. So I think, again, that shows that no one treatment works for everyone.
Mm,
You also mentioned that you interviewed a lot of farmers, and we know, unfortunately, farmers have got a high rate of mental illness. What were some of their thoughts around some of the causes behind mental illness and what could help?
I think the biggest thing for rural New Zealand, and this was from farmers but also from others who lived in rural New Zealand, was the isolation and the stigma still being very strong. Thankfully, we have people who we met along the road and I know who are doing amazing work, like Doug Avery, who are helping farming communities see that it's not weakness to speak about any and all of the challenges, not just we've had a drought, but how does that drought affect on your own well-being? And his book, The Resilient Farmer, I know is having an impact, because it's a plain language way to talk about those things. And so it was good to hear that people say that there is some support there, but at times not necessarily coming in the form that works. So I guess we heard a bit about Doug's work, but in other communities where there wasn't a Doug, it was at times that community had to wrap around itself, or maybe there wasn't a strong wraparound, which I think can make it very difficult if you're wanting support, or if you're not sure if you want support but there's nothing really there, or perceived to be nothing there. And there was also a discussion about whether whether technology approaches can work, and some said they could, but others said it needs the authenticity, it needs to have the voice and the face and the grounding of what we're used to, and it can't be necessarily an urban person trying to reflect on our lives. Maybe it could be, but not always is that going to be able to cut through.
And you mentioned that farmers often have huge financial pressures, floods or various things going wrong. Did they talk about how much that often contributed to mental distress?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think the boom and the bust was a strong theme from rural New Zealand, and there was also a sense that that's a regular part of the work, and I guess connecting to a broader theme of the inquiry, there are some areas of New Zealand or some areas of work where we know there's going to be high stress in some parts of it, and so how do we tailor mental wellbeing support in those areas, in those times? Like we can sort of foresee when some calamities are developing, like with Imbovis, we knew that was coming, and before the culling of, and we heard some of this as well, before the culling of the animals, we might have been able to put in place something which could have helped the farmers in a deeper way than when that happened. That some people would reflect on things like that, so it was very, very raw and still a lot of hurt around that.
Did you hear from any of the families of farmers?
Yes, we did. Again, it was a lot around having to carry things alone sometimes, being very strong and resilient, and making things work. At times it was a very number eight wire kind of moment when we would listen to some farming communities and families, and the courage, again, that I could hear and what they were doing and how they were getting by at times is... Yeah, it reminds me as a city slicker how fortunate I am.
Mm. Yeah, I've certainly not the first. I'd like to get up at 4:30 a.m. and milk cows every morning.
Yeah, exactly. But we need it, eh?
We do.
And so, as a country, we rely a lot on our primary industries, and so
we
it's kind of as much as possible. Us in the urban areas not forgetting about those people who are doing the heavy lifting for us in a.
Before you mentioned Doug Avery, and he wrote the book The Resilient Farmer, can you just tell us a little bit about his story? Because people have found that very helpful.
Oh, sure, yeah. So I guess as I had talked about a drought, one of the droughts was a drought up in Marlborough, which Doug was a farmer, he was a farmer at the time, and I think the drought lasted about 8 years. And over that time, he progressively was just becoming, I guess, sadder was, I think, the way he framed it, feeling like he couldn't talk to anyone about it or not knowing where to go for help, but also not really seeing an end to the drought, and that sort of affecting his family and the community around him, and him wanting to see the pain end. It led to a very depressive state and time, and in a way he found support. And that helped him get through, and finding that he wanted other farmers to experience what he had, that while it can seem an inevitable, hopeless space at times, there are places you can draw from, and some of that was himself, and that's partly, I think, why it's called The Resilient Farmer. He recognised that some of what we have in urban New Zealand won't be there and can't be there. So we've got to find something that connects in a way that's authentic here. Mm.
Fantastic. Well, that's all we have time for on today's show, but we've got Josiah back next week to continue this conversation. Take care.
When the nights get cold and the lights go out, the sun is gone behind the clouds, and you feel lost, and I'll reach out to guide you home.